Court will now call United States v. Bennett. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. My name is Major Jacob Bayshore, and I, along with Colonel Patricia Hamm, represent the appellant, Private Timothy Bennett. In our briefs, we laid out five primary reasons why Private Bennett's conviction for involuntary manslaughter is legally insufficient. I'd like to concentrate on two key points that encapsulate our entire argument. One, regarding Article 77, as Ms. King did not commit an offense, that is, because her use of oxymorphone was not a crime, Private Bennett cannot be held liable under the theory charged for aiding and abetting Ms. King's use. Two, regarding Article 119b2, specifically the second and the fourth elements, as Private Bennett's acts must have caused Ms. King's death, and his acts must have occurred while he was perpetrating an offense that was directly affecting the person, the charge is legally insufficient because Private Bennett's acts, they ceased prior to Ms. King stepping up to the table and on her own using the oxymorphone. First, Ms. King's use of oxymorphone is not a crime. LaFave summarizes this the error of the law.
Can I ask you a question about that? Are you relying on the Article 77, or are you relying on the specification itself for the focus on whether it's her wrongful act that's in question?
Under the Article 77 analysis, Chief Judge Baker, it goes both ways. The government specifically charged Private Bennett with aiding and abetting the wrongful use of oxymorphone. Ms. King's acts of using oxymorphone was not a crime, not a crime in the state of Washington.
So just to be clear, it is your view that you look at that issue from the perspective of Ms. King, not the perspective of the person being charged?
Yes, Your Honor. The government...
And do you get that because of the text of Article 77, or do you get that because of the manner in which the specification was drafted, or both?
Well, both.
Or from some other source?
Yes, Your Honor. Both. The law has been clear. It's clear in the federal courts, and it's clear in this court, from Pritchett and Jones, that the perpetrator of the crime must actually commit an offense. That is, they must commit a crime in order for an accessory to be held liable. Here, Ms. King didn't violate any law by her actual use. If she violated any law, it was simply possession. Like distribution, possession is not an offense that directly affects the person. What the government wants this court to focus on is jurisdiction. They didn't have jurisdiction over Ms. King. It's not just about jurisdiction. It's the fact that Ms. King's acts do not fall under the UCMJ. Federal law does not make her acts a crime on federal installation. And state law doesn't make her act of using a crime. As the Supreme Court said in Standiford, reiterating what it said in Shuttlesworth, the perpetrator must actually commit a crime.
Yep, counsel.
Yes, sir.
I don't quite understand the Chief Judge's question and your answers. I thought that Bennett was charged with his own crime, which the commentators came up with as being a misdemeanor homicide, as a felony murder. Misdemeanor homicide is the conduct of Bennett that's at issue.
Yes, Your Honor, it is the conduct of Bennett when we're looking at...
What the victim does is not relevant, is it?
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
Well,
Article 77...
Counselor, are you talking about with respect to Specification 2?
Yes, Your Honor. If it was a Specification 1 offense solely under culpable negligence, it would not be about Ms. King's use. That's a contributory negligence.
Yeah, but it's Bennett was committing the crime upon a person.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe he committed any crime against the person. His acts merely amounted to distribution.
Well, that's a crime, by the way.
That is a crime.
And this court held that crime results in a death under the Sargent rationale, we look at what the distribution was and how it was done, time, place, and circumstance, don't we?
You can look at those aspects, yes, Your Honor. But
so you don't disagree under the facts of this case that he distributed the drug by putting two lines on a table, whereupon she ingested it and thereafter died. Her conduct's irrelevant, isn't it?
It is not irrelevant, Your Honor, because of the way the conduct was charged. Sergeant, if this court accepts the rationale in Sergeant.
Counsel, it might be helpful when you're talking about the charge and her conduct to distinguish between Specification 1 and Specification 2, because you don't disagree that her conduct has nothing to do with Specification 1.
That's correct, Your Honor, and he was acquitted of that specification. Under a culpable negligence theory, her conduct is irrelevant. I mean, obviously, she had to use drugs. But if you're looking at Sergeant, when it's talking in dicta about aiding and abetting use, first, it's talking in the context that both Sergeant and Dillon, the decedents, were service members. So it was, in fact, a crime for those service members to use when you're looking at the Article 77 analysis. But further, if this court accepts that dicta as being a proper rule of law to find a crime directly affecting the person, immediately before that dicta, this court cited Forsman. And in Forsman, it's a Minnesota case, Forsman actually plunged the syringe into the vein of the decedent. And that is the type of offense directly affecting the person that Sergeant was referring to, not simply the distribution. And that's what Private Bennett did here.
You're blending your two arguments, though, aren't you?
They do blend, Your Honor. They certainly do blend.
Why don't you continue working on your first argument?
On Article 77? It is our primary.
Well, responding to Judge Cox's questions about whose offense are we really looking at and why.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you feel you have, then that's fine, too. But
no, that's fine, Your Honor. We're looking at Private Bennett's acts. But under Article 77, in the way this was charged, it wasn't solely his acts, because he hadn't aided and abetted an actual crime. And here he did not. The government wants this court to look at Article 77 as if it's its own punitive article. Article 77 is merely a theory of liability. That is the vehicle by which an accessory can be found guilty of a punitive article.
Is it wrongful to use oxy, whatever it is, in a barracks room?
It would be wrongful if Private Bennett were to use in the barracks room.
But it's not wrongful for a civilian to do so?
No more than it is for them to possess, Your Honor.
So it is wrongful?
In that regard, yes, Your Honor. But it's not the offense of wrongful use as defined by the code. And simply adding the word wrongful in front of use doesn't make her acts a crime.
No, I understand. You got the word her in front of wrongful. But if this thing were charged as unlawfully kill Miss King by aiding or abetting the wrongful use of oxymorphone, whatever it is, do you have the same issue or not? Is it, in fact, wrongful to use oxy-whatever in a barracks room?
I believe it's the same exact issue, Your Honor. There's no difference. You have to look at the government charges through Article 87 or 77, so you have to look at the aiding and abetting aspect of it. And
well, under your theory, or under that theory, Ms. King would have to be guilty of her own involuntary homicide for me to aid and abet her own involuntary manslaughter. And I don't recognize that theory of law.
That's part of our problem with the charge in and of itself.
Because a person can't involuntarily kill themselves.
That's right, Judge Cox.
The
government cites no cases where the victim is the perpetrator of her own crime. When you're looking at the history of Article 119b2, we're looking at types of offenses that involve, as this court said in Sergeant, physical violence against the third party, assault, maiming, battery, false imprisonment. Those are the types of crimes that encompass directly affecting the person. Controlled substance type crimes are not meant to protect the individual. 112 Alpha was incorporated in order to protect military society. And as the New York court said in Greico, when it was discussing what directly affecting the person meant, it specifically said, in that case, a reckless driving while intoxicated, which struck and killed a pedestrian, which at least superficially appears to directly affect at least that person, that in fact was not so, because the crime was one against society. And that is the same reason that we have 112 Alpha. It's for military discipline. It's for military readiness. It is not to protect the individual from harming themselves.
Isn't this more akin to giving the keys to an intoxicated driver and that driver kills herself rather than an innocent victim?
Under 119b2, Judge Cox, that would still not be an offense. Under 119b1, under the culpable negligence theory,
but under Sergeant's distinction between merely distributing the drug versus assisting in the use of it. That it's dicta, granted.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's dicta, but it certainly seems like a rational basis to, if you're at a fraternity party and you got a drunk buddy and you start feeding him shots, you're distributing alcohol to a minor, but you also, if he dies,
I think that is
that's involuntary manslaughter.
Yes, Your Honor, under 119B1, under a culpable negligence theory, it very well may be, but not under 119B1.
That's not culpable negligence, that's intentional act.
But we have two points as it deals with 119B2. The first part is the while perpetrating an offense. Private Bennett's acts must have continued on when she committed her act which caused her death. Private Bennett had ceased all distribution, all aiding and abetting, whatever this court would like to call it, prior to her use. He divides the pill, he steps back. Congress could have put a different word in this statute instead of while. They could have put as a result of, which would be infinitely more broad than what we have in this statute. As Sergeant recognized, when Article of War 93, which was an unlawful act, malum in se, when they went from that language to the directly affecting the person language, it narrowed the scope of the involuntary manslaughter under 119B2. It did not expand it. And what the government wants to do is blow the doors off of 119B2 to basically encompass any act where a death is caused. And I think that kind of goes to your questions, Judge Cox. It's not just that there's a death or that there was an unlawful act. The unlawful act had to be continuing. It had to be ongoing that directly affected the person. The plain language doesn't allow this court to affirm. And if you're looking at congressional intent, I also don't believe it allows this court to affirm. I believe the court got it wrong in Sargent when it was talking about the aiding and abetting use. In 1951, when 119B2 was enacted, drug offenses were malum prohibitum, as reiterated by the Air Force Court in 1955 in Cabot. This Congress narrowed the field in 119B2 by the change of the language of the malum in se. So they narrowed the 119, the malum in se language, and it wasn't until decades later that some courts, not all courts, found drug offenses to become malum in se.
If we find that it's not an offense directly affecting the person, we don't need to get into any of the rest of this stuff, do we?
That's right, Your Honor.
You don't have to get into aiding and abetting. You don't have to get into whether he mashed it or cut it. You don't have to get into any of that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. There are several grounds that this court can find legally insufficient, and we've identified at least five. This court only needs to address one of them.
And your essential argument there is that there's a break, an air gap, between the person who sticks the heroin in the person's arm and the person who puts it on the table and walks away.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that's why the court cited Forsman right before it started talking about the aiding and abetting use. That's the type of aiding and abetting use, because the crime is still ongoing because you have the
And I don't want to be facetious, but if the person puts it on the table and puts up a little sign saying, come here, here it is, and it's flashing neon, you're saying as long as there's no physical contact between the two people, you have a sufficient air break that it's not a continuing offense.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not a continuing offense, and it's the actual act of the, if you want to call it a victim, who injects themselves, who does their own acts that causes their death. Simply distribution in of itself, as held in Sargent, then again in Dillon, specifically identified even sale and presence.
So there's not a continuum here. There's a full black and white break at the point at which there is physical contact or there is not.
That's right, Your Honor.
From your standpoint.
That's right, Your Honor. And in this case, there obviously was no physical contact. There's no even evidence that he encouraged her in any way. The only word that he admits to saying is the word yes when she asked if she could, her and Miss Yoakum could split the pill. And that in and of itself is not sufficient to even meet the dicta language in Sargent if this court determines that it should accept that language. And that's why the charge is legally insufficient in and of itself. Any new questions?
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Thank you. Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Ken Bornino, along with my co-counsel, Captain Chad Fisher, represent the government. Aiding and abetting the wrongful use of a controlled substance is an offense directly affecting the person sufficient to justify conviction for involuntary manslaughter under Article 119 UCMJ. This court's statement to that effect in United States versus Sargent should officially be adopted as the law in this jurisdiction. There are two primary questions in this case. The first is whether aiding and abetting the wrongful use of a controlled substance is an offense under Article 77. And the second is whether that offense is one that directly affects the person.
Now, you put in the word the wrongful use, and the specification says her wrongful use. Which is it?
Well, it would be her wrongful use, Your Honor, because, I mean, obviously, appellant can't aid and abet his own wrongful use. So the issue here is the nature of the charging. It is her use, but appellant's offense is his aiding and abetting in that use.
Was her use a crime?
Say again, Your Honor?
Was her use a crime?
It was, Your Honor. It would be.
How so?
Because it would violate 10 U.S.C. 819-912-alpha, which, you know, obviously, she's not subject to jurisdiction under the UCMJ, and it's not an offense under state law, and it's not an offense under federal law, but it is under an offense under the UCMJ. And for purposes of Article 77, the question for aiding and abetting is whether or not an offense under the code has been committed. And as courts have made clear, both the Army and Air Force courts have adopted, the amenability of the actual perpetrator to prosecution is not a requirement for criminal liability as an aider and abetter.
What about the cases that this court has issued where it says that the principal must have committed an offense? Some of those cases have said they have to be an offense under the UCMJ, but they have, the ones that have addressed it have said that it must be an offense. And it seems to me you're arguing that it can be this nebulous general offense, not the specific offense that was charged in the case. And that gets us into a situation where, under the government's theory, a person can be held or found guilty of aiding and abetting a non-criminal act that was charged.
No, Your Honor, I believe the question is, and it is the specific offense, and the question is whether or not a specific offense under the code was committed. And the question is not to look at the status of the perpetrator, it's to look at the acts actually performed by the perpetrator. And an easy way to look at it is, had this been specialist Leah King, her actions clearly would have violated 112 alpha. And so that's the point here, is the factual background and the acts done.
Wait a minute. Is the government saying, you're saying that admittedly there's no jurisdiction over this person, Mrs. King?
Yes, sir.
Therefore, it can't be a crime under the code for Ms. King to do this.
Well, it's still a crime. She's just
Wait a minute. If something, let's say something is prohibited in Rwanda, but it's not prohibited in any jurisdiction in the United States. Is that enough to drag it in? You seem to be saying that. Rwanda has no jurisdiction. The code has no jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is it enough that it's prohibited somewhere in the world?
No, Your Honor, and that's actually the point, is it has to be prohibited under the UCMJ, and that's the question here under 77, by the plain language of the statute, is you have to aid and abet an offense under the code.
But don't you have to take an additional step based on the way this crime was charged, where it said that he unlawfully killed King by aiding and abetting her wrongful use? Now, I understand your argument, but you have to agree that her use wasn't criminal under any code.
I believe it would be criminal under the UCMJ, Your Honor.
But she's not subject to the UCMJ.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's not the question. And as, you know, the Army Court of the United States versus Minor and the Air Force Court of Blevins made clear, it doesn't matter if you're not subject to jurisdiction. The question is whether or not your acts constitute
the
offense.
Have we ever held that?
No, this court has not. But implicitly, it has in United States versus Hill and United States versus Jones. Both were distribution cases where the perpetrator was a civilian. So this court could not have upheld the conviction for aiding and abetting the distribution under the theory that because the perpetrator was not subject to the UCMJ, they could not properly be aided and abetted.
Just to help me along here, they're underway on a carrier visit, and the civilian decides to jump overboard. And the military member escorts them to the rail and says, this is a good place to jump overboard. It'll be fun to watch them do an overboard drill. Is that aiding and abetting boat jumping?
It could be, Your Honor, because the question in the circumstance is whether or not an offense under the code, under the code has been committed for purposes of Article 77. And the idea is,
so that person is a civilian.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you'd say it's an offense because it's an offense under the code?
Correct, Your Honor, because the factual predicate would have met the elements of the offense. And essentially, the easy way to look at it is if that person was a service member, would their actions have constituted a violation of an offense under the code? And the question for aiding and abetting is whether the service member, with equal intent as the actual perpetrator, has somehow aided and or abetted that person engaging that offense.
But it's not an offense.
And I think what we're kind of stuck at, Your Honor, is kind of the metaphysical debate. As if a person commits an offense in the force and no one's there to have jurisdiction, is it still a crime? And that's kind of where we're at. Like, appellant's argument is that, look, because you don't have jurisdiction over her, it's not a crime. And the government's argument is, statutorily, Article 112 Alpha is an offense.
Okay.
It creates an offense for wrongful.
You seem like a very intelligent guy. Can't you think of a lot of things that would be an offense under the code that no civilian could ever even be accused of or charged? For example, failing to render proper salute to the colors at retreat, things like that.
Correct, Your Honor. At one point,
and you're saying a guy could aid and abet that by encouraging her not to do what she doesn't have to do.
And it depends on the circumstances of that case, Your Honor. It depends on the level of aiding and abetting and whether or not the accused shares in that intent. Because the question is whether or not the accused is properly subject to criminal liability. And the problem with this argument about whether or not someone is amenable to prosecution, meaning making it a crime, would mean that no service member could ever aid and abet a civilian in the commission of any offense.
But it's not. It has nothing to do with jurisdiction if our conduct itself is not criminal.
Yes, Your Honor, and her conduct in this case would be criminal under 112 Alpha, which is the offense.
But it's not criminal for her to do it.
She could not be prosecuted for it, but it still would violate 112 Alpha.
But it means she couldn't be prosecuted anywhere for it.
No, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't that what the problem is? It's not just the code. It's that what she did was not a crime.
Correct, Your Honor. Under Washington State and federal law, it would be a crime. But under the UCMJ, which is what 77 looks at, it would be a crime.
Is there any other way it might be wrongful? It's a question, not a statement.
Right, Ryan. There's a couple points.
It's either wrongful under 112 or it isn't, period. Thank you. And that's the break point in this case. We either write it that way or we don't.
Well, that's one piece to it, and that's one question regarding the elements, because obviously she used the controlled substance, and so then the next question is whether or not her actions would constitute wrongfulness under 112 Alpha. And a couple points regarding that. Just from a straight statutory definition point, wrongfulness is a term of art used in the statute, and it's been further defined by the President, pursuant to his Article 36 powers, as wrong. It is wrongful so long as there is no lawful justification or excuse. And the only three exceptions for lawful justifications or excuses recognized by the President are for official law enforcement activities, for medical purposes, or where you lack the knowledge of the substance, of what the substance actually is. And none of those three exceptions actually apply here, because she was not acting in law enforcement capacity, she did not have a prescription for the oxymorphone, and she clearly knew what it was at that point, or at least the clear inferences in the case that she knew what she was taking. So based on the definitions taken by the President, her use would be wrongful because she does not have that lawful justification or excuse under the statute.
Have you cited in your brief, and I apologize because I read it a couple of days ago, but have you cited in your brief other what I'll call misdemeanor homicide cases where the theory of prosecution was that the accused aided and abetted the deceased in the commission of a misdemeanor?
Correct, Your Honor. And there would be a number of different cases. The first would be State versus Forsman out of Minnesota. It's not necessarily charged aiding and abetting, but a factual predicate was he assisted in the person injecting heroin.
Any under the Uniform Code?
Not under the Uniform Code, Your Honor. Not for military. We have state cases, and particularly state cases from California, where their statute had the more general language of committing an offense, essentially a misdemeanor, that leads to the individual's death. And those would be people who
So if you have... If you have two young men that go into a 7-Eleven type store and steal a candy bar, say that's a misdemeanor of petty theft, and the owner shoots and kills one of them, can you convict the other one on the theory of involuntary manslaughter because he was aiding and abetting in the commission of a misdemeanor?
No, Your Honor, because the question for 119b2 119b2 is the question of whether or not it directly affects the person. And so the stealing the candy bar will not directly affect the person. Whereas here we have an offense that does directly affect the person.
How?
Because wrongful use, just by the plain language of the rule, And the definitions that have been enacted. So in Article 119, directly affecting the person means that one affecting some particular person as distinguished from an offense affecting society in general. And as this court pointed out in Sargent, it must affect not only an individual, but also the physical person of that individual.
Right. Doesn't the list given in the manual all point toward offenses having a physical impact on the body?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think...
Like assaults, you know, batteries, so forth.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think in that respect, wrongful use of a controlled substance is identical to those other...
How?
Because of the fact that when you look at...
He didn't stick a needle in her. He didn't hit her and shove it down her mouth.
Correct, Your Honor. He didn't
do anything. He left it there for her to do whatever it was she wanted to do with it. How is that an offense directly affecting the person as... traditionally understood?
Well, the government would disagree that he didn't do anything. The argument here is that he aided and abetted in that wrongful use. The wrongful use would be the offense directly.
No. I'm not concerned with aiding and abetting. Leave that aside. I'm concerned with what is an offense directly affecting the person.
This is going to Appellant's second argument.
Right.
Correct, Your Honor. And wrongful use of a controlled substance would be an offense directly affecting the person.
How?
Because of the fact that it directly affects a particular person and has a physical effect on that individual's body. As the Army Court has stated that the fact in regard to other offense and other drugs, the fact that cocaine has been designated a controlled substance by Congress standing alone means that it has been determined to be potentially harmful. That's from United States versus Henderson.
Right, that sounds societal, not individual.
Right, but that's the point, that it's clear that drugs have a...
You can't have it both ways.
But the fact is that in a particular case, only a single individual can use the drug at a particular time. And then, so that's the first problem, whether or not it affects a particular individual. And the second problem is whether or not it has a physical effect on the body. And drugs clearly have a physical effect on the body. And I think this goes directly to the point of, you know, when Congress amended Article 119 to remove the distinction between malum incident and malum prohibitum offenses, the idea is to provide greater...
That's another question. Did they really do that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Sargent, going through the legislative history, makes it clear that there was a separate proposal for...
Well,
separate...
but there was a separate proposal that would have adhered more closely to the Article of War. But to say that they didn't adhere more closely to the Article of War and to say that they extinguished the distinction are two different things.
Right, Your Honor. And they don't make specifically clear...
No, they don't. The legislative history really doesn't say anything about it, does it?
No, Your Honor, but you can look...
Well, then, where are we?
But you can look as a corollary to Louisiana statute that has the executive...
I don't care about Louisiana. I mean, you're quoting California, you're quoting Louisiana... But you haven't given us anything except Sargent, and Sargent seems to go the other way.
Well, Your Honor, Sargent makes clear that aiding and abetting the wrongful use of a controlled substance could be an offense directly affecting the person.
If there is something beyond giving them the substance.
Right, Your Honor. And what Sargent made clear was just the mere handing you of a drug is just a distribution and therefore cannot be an offense directly affecting the person. Well, what it points out is that if you go further and take additional steps to actually assist in that use, then that could be one affecting the person.
Right. Number one, of course, it's dictum. And number two, do you really think it should turn on whether he mashed it or cut it? Is that a sensible criminal distinction in criminal law, or whether he left it there as a pill or mashed it?
Sure, Your Honor, and it's going to depend on the circumstances of the case. At the far extreme, you have the state versus Forsman idea, where you have someone actually injecting the heroin
right.
into someone's body.
Right, and that I think that would be something Chief Judge Everett would say is directly affecting the person.
Right, and that would be the clear example of... directly affecting the person, or assisting in such a manner to directly affect the person. On the other spectrum, we have merely handing the drug. But there's the possibility that somewhere within the middle, there's still sufficient facts that can lead to someone actually assisting in the use of a controlled substance. And you have other cases from other jurisdictions which look at this issue and find much less assistance than actually injecting the drug into the person's body, and is finding support for the fact
Do those cases come from states that have the same statute?
Similar statute, Your Honor. Particularly California, while it doesn't have the directly affecting the person language, it does have the offense. But in finding that someone aided and abetted in the use of the controlled substance in State versus Hopkins, the mere fact that he accused, held the bandana around the arm to pop the vein out was sufficient while the...
That involves physical contact.
Correct, Your Honor.
That does directly affect, makes the vein stand out. That's not this case.
Correct, Your Honor, but the making the vein stand out is not the offense that will directly affect the person. It is the injection of the drug, which was done by the decedent in that case. But further, in People versus Oliver, you have a circumstance where all the accused did was provide the spoon that was going to be used.
Okay, and where is People v. Oliver from?
And that's from California as well.
Okay, and California doesn't have the same statute, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Very similar.
Thank you.
And the point here, Your Honor, is that these offenses, and when you look at the other offenses listed on Article 119, and when you do away with the idea of malum in se, and we take this directly affecting the person, the idea is that not every malum in se offense would necessarily potentially lead to death. And I think, you know, this Court's analysis of the felony murder statute is pointing out that Congress's goal in there was removing the foreseeability aspect as to those felony murders, or those felonies, because of the concept that Congress has decided that if these types of felonies are ones that it is probable or possible that a death could result from.
Sounds to me like you're getting over into culpable negligence. If you do something and it has the effect of, you know, and you do something negligently and it has a bad effect, but unfortunately he was acquitted of that.
Yeah, no, actually, that's what I'm trying to distinguish it from culpable negligence, Your Honor. Because
well, you're talking about murder, which, of course, is negligent.
Right, but what I'm discussing is the felony murder statute, where Congress has decided if you commit this felony and someone dies as a result, you can be convicted of that murder.
Well, what's the felony murder statute got to do with it?
Because of the fact that what Congress has done here, you have two separate provisions. You have culpable negligence, which deals with what the accused knew at the time and whether or not it was foreseeable that the death would occur. You have also this listing of an offense directly affecting the person. And the issue there is more like the felony murder concept, where Congress has decided by using this definition, offense directly affecting the person, we are looking at ones that necessarily could lead to death. Because one that directly affects the person is one that has to physically affect the physical person. So there's always the possibility that someone could die as a result of it. And so for an assault and a maiming, a voluntary entering into a fray, those types of physical effects on a person could potentially lead to death, such that if you engage in one and someone dies, you can properly be held guilty of involuntary manslaughter. And wrongful use of a controlled substance fits exactly into that same concept, because if you use a controlled substance, it will have a direct effect on your body, and it is likely probable or possible that someone will end up dying for it, such that an accused could properly be convicted of involuntary manslaughter for aiding and abetting in that wrongful use, which led to the decedent's death.
Counsel, in response to the appellant's first argument, whether or not she had to be committing an offense rather than just a general offense, your argument is that it just has to be a general offense punishable under the code. And we go from there to your second argument, and there you argue that we have to specifically look at King, this particular victim. Isn't there some essential inconsistency there?
Well, no, I don't know that I'm arguing that it has to be just some general offense. I think the offense under the code has to be identified that you're aiding and abetting. So the identified offense under the code here is 112 alpha.
But you're arguing that it doesn't matter as to her specifically because she's not subject to it.
Right. And the issue there, it doesn't matter as to her status, but it matters as to what acts she has performed. And the question is whether or not her acts have constituted a violation of that code. Such that, for example, Article 77 only applies to offenses under the code. So if a civilian murders someone and a soldier aids and abets that civilian in that murder, under appellant's theory, the government and the military could not prosecute that soldier under the Article 77 theory or a violation of 118 because of the fact that the person who committed the crime was not subject to the code.
Are you aware of any jurisdiction where a person can be convicted of aiding and abetting a principal who cannot be prosecuted for the specific act charged?
Not particularly, Your Honor, because that's one of the difficult aspects, especially when you look at state and federal law, is most of their jurisdiction is based on territorial aspects. So usually the crime is being committed within their territorial jurisdiction. It's because we are a unique jurisdiction in that ours is based on status, and so we have the potential where someone, a principal, could not be in the status of a soldier, whereas the aider and abettor is a soldier who is assisting in that offense. But that doesn't necessarily mean that these...
And in that analysis, does it make any difference that the civilian criminal law has not made that act criminal?
No, Your Honor, because the only question is going to be under 77, whether or not the offense under the code, the particular offense under the code, has been committed by the facts in that case.
Can I just test what it is that you're saying? I'm going to change the offense and change the parties, okay? So instead of it being the distribution of drugs and the person being a civilian, going to have it be kidnapping. Okay, and they're both service members, and service member A is the perpetrator, okay, the primary actor. And the child that she kidnaps is her own child, okay, and the other person aids and abets her in doing that. Under the code, at least as I read the discussion code, the perpetrator can't be found guilty of kidnapping because it was her own child. Can the aider and abettor be found guilty of kidnapping?
And it's possible, Your Honor. And I'm not sure about the outer bounds of how far 77 could be applied in that context. And
but this seems like a perfect, you know, example to test your hypothesis, which is it doesn't matter because I don't think anyone would disagree that kidnapping is an offense under the code.
Right, Your Honor. And the one distinction, though, there is that perpetrator A in that case didn't commit a crime at all. Would not have committed.
But it's an offense under the code.
Correct, Your Honor, and didn't commit the offense under the code. And so that would be the distinction here, whereas the victim in this case did commit an offense under the code. She may not have been subject to jurisdiction, but the offense was still committed. And I think that would be the distinction between those two concepts. I see that I'm out of time. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, please.
Chief Judge Baker, just a few points. To Judge Ryan, to your question to government counsel regarding United States v. Hill, which was an answer to both your question and Judge Erdman's question, the government is asking this court to overturn decades of case law. They're asking you to overturn Hill, not to follow Hill. Hill involved a case where there was a transfer of controlled substance between two government agents, an informant and an agent, and this court found that that transfer was not unlawful. Thus, the accessory could not be held liable for that lawful transfer. This court would have to completely overturn that case law, which is consistent with federal circuit courts and state courts holding just that. Judge Erdman, your question about jurisdiction. For the last 80 years, out of the Ninth Circuit in Kichi Ito has been valid law, and that is where jurisdiction was not had on the perpetrators, thus they had not committed an offense, yet thus in Kichi Ito could not be found liable. That court said if Congress wanted to expand the statute in order to cover their offense, it could have, but since it didn't, the perpetrators didn't commit an offense, thus in Kichi Ito could not be held liable. To the questions from Judge Cox and Judge Stuckey, asking government counsel about case law outside of the military, and the government counsel repeatedly cites California case law. California case law is not similar at all to our statute. It is simply that an unlawful act occurs, which is very similar, Judge Cox, I think, to the idea that the misdemeanor occurs, a death occurs, thus you have involuntary manslaughter. Our statute is much more detailed. It has a while component, and it has a directly affecting the person component.
Second, what concerns me about the analysis we're going through, it looks to me like that sergeant, if it's good law, establishes a continuum, the alpha being transferring the drugs and the omega being injecting the heroin, And this one seems to me to fall somewhere along that line, whether or not he actually assisted her in using the drug or whether he just merely gave it to her. And under Jackson v. Virginia, and looking at all the evidence with reasonable inference to the government, where do we come down?
Your Honor, I believe we come down as a distribution. Again, the government cited Forsman, which this court cited in Sargent. That court said the actual injection with, you know, pushing the plunger into the arm, that qualifies.
But see, what you're saying is he could have pushed the plunger in her arm and still wouldn't be guilty under your theory that she wasn't committing any offense. And I don't know if I buy that.
It's whether this court would find that to be a crime directly affecting the person. I think if that was the case, the government wouldn't have used this creative charging in order to charge the aiding and abetting wrongful use.
How would her conduct be wrongful there? You just said you concede that would meet your second argument, but what about your first argument?
I don't believe that Congress ever intended for the directly affecting the person statute to encompass controlled substances, Your Honor. They cite the case in Forsman, and Forsman is clear, if you have something less than the actual pushing of the plunger, that's a different analysis. So Forsman isn't hey, well, we have a continuum, and even in that continuum, you're good to go. Enforcement says we're not reaching that conclusion, and this court shouldn't either, because it doesn't need to. The acts of Craig Bennett were solely surrounding his act of distribution. He stepped away. His conduct ceased. He did nothing further to aid in that period.
But just to go back to Judge Cox's scenario with the, there's no air gap in this hypothetical. And it's injection, and he's hammering on the needle, so there's no question physical force is being used. Now address your first argument, which is nonetheless her conduct was or was not wrongful or doesn't matter, or at this time we have a completed offense.
Your Honor, I think it depends how the government charges it. If they charge it like they did in this case, aiding and abetting wrongful use, the charge must fail because he did not aid and abet a use. He didn't aid and abet a crime. If they didn't charge it that way and they tried to charge it in the way that his actual plunging was the act, there was no wrongful use required, we still don't believe that Congress intended the language of directly affecting the person to encapsulate this kind of act. So either way.
Okay. It is a fair response. Other questions or comments? The court thanks both counsel for your argument today, and we will stand in recess until 20 past the hour. Thank you.
All rise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court stands in recess until 10:20.